Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 28th of October 2012. My name's TRP Watson, and this week I'm joined by Nick from Partially Obstructed View and Paul Chandler. We're now going to talk about You Can Still Make a Killing at the Southwark Playhouse. This is a play by Nicholas Pierpan and is directed by Matthew Dunster. It's a play that takes place over, I think it's about three or four years of the financial crisis. From about 2008, we have a character who is working at Lehman Brothers and is selling a rather weird financial product to his friend, who's part of a private equity fund, that's one. And he's trying to sell it, and the deal falls through, if nothing else, because Lehman Brothers goes out of business and the man loses his job. We then see this man trying to get back into the financial services, hanging about in coffee bars in the right parts of the town to see if he can get an interview with somebody, and finally going to work with the financial I think it's the financial regulation authority. They're rather careful here in this play. There are one or two people who are mentioned. They do mention things like Lloyd's and other banks, but they don't mention. Yes, I think they call it RNBS, the Royal National Bank of Scotland, rather than RBS, and they don't call it the FSA, the Financial Services Authority. They call it the FRA, I think. So they're trying to make sure that that they're not sailing too close to the wind here. Anyway, he joins the FRA, the FRS, and starts investigating people, including his friend at the private equity firm, and ends up. We end up with certain accusations of insider trading, and our main character goes from low to high. I think we can safely say in this play, it's really quite well done. I think, and it's a good cast. I mean, people like particularly like Kelly Bright. You have a nice bit from Robert Gwilym. I think the problem I had with this play really was that the main character is not just unsympathetic. It's that he's empty, and I think he's deliberately empty. He's sort of this sort of empty package who can really only do very few things, and you just don't care about him at all. But it is a fairly interesting play. Nick, what did you think about it?
Yeah, I thought it was a very, very good play. I agree. He's certainly not a likable central character, and he is kind of I know what you mean, because he's very much blown on the wind, and he's very much a very different character depending on what's going on with him at any given time. I actually think that's not the fact of it, but I think it leads towards one of the things I really liked about the play, which is that it plays with a lot of stereotypes and a lot of kind of cliches of how this story kind of goes, and of the kind of cliches of the person who kind of loses everything but gains kind of a lot as a person. And it kind of it plays with your expectations of these, and it makes you think you know where it's going, and then it kind of subverts these sorts of things in a couple of ways. I thought it was very, very well, acted, very well directed. It's and it's always a good sign when you have one of these plays that opens that's on a very, very specific subject matter that you don't necessarily, if you're me, know much about in detail. And there's and you get this opening scene where people are kind of chucking words about coupons and haircuts to each other that clearly mean something to them that other than what those words mean to me. So and you get this kind of opening that is might as well be gibberish, and very quickly you feel like you're being brought into the world of it and being made to understand something about what's going on, and the technicalities of it, as well as certainly much more what this is about is the personalities behind it, more than something like Enron, for example, which was very good at kind of explaining how these things worked and how these things happened. This is much more about the characters who can make that sort of thing seem a reasonable way to go about your life. There's there's what seems, especially at first, it's kind of a fairly small part, is there's an American lady played by Alexi Walker, who she's very good. She was about this time last year, she was at the same theatre playing Katerina in The Shrew. And she's quite an interesting character because she's someone who comes across incredibly likeable and warm to start with, certainly by the standards of the traders we meet. And actually, the more it goes on, the more she's really one of the most kind of shameless and kind of quite vicious traders who doesn't care who she hurts. So it's a character piece about the financial crisis. So it's quite different maybe to everything we've seen in recent years about the subject. Except, I mean, the only thing really that went to that kind of area was again Peter Pan's previous play, which was The Maddening Rain, which was a monologue about a trader who kind of and how he kind of got into it through largely a series of coincidences. So I think he's got an interesting kind of way of looking at the subject, and of not necessarily demonizing the people who do this in the way that in the way that maybe the media does, or that maybe some stories about this sort of thing will tell you about these terrible people who are, you know, destroying the economy for their own gain. He has more of a he kind of wants you to see them as people who kind of fall into these sort of things, and he kind of makes you see that the bad guy of the last few years in the media, it could be anybody who falls into that situation and finds themselves kind of doing these pretty appalling things.
Paul, what did you think of it?
Well, first things first, I'm a big fan of The Upper Hand, so any chance to see Kelly Bright on stage is one that I'm going to grab with both hands. But no, I really, really enjoyed this. I'm kind of predisposed to like anything about the financial crisis, I think, because I find it weirdly fascinating for some reason. I enjoyed The Power of Yes. I've read books on the subject. You know, any time there's a documentary on or anything, I'll be watching that. And I find the idea of the character sympathisation really interesting. I was reading a book called Too Big to Fail, which takes you right through the American side of the financial crisis, almost day by day, you know, all these incredible inside conversations that took place. And you start to, sympathise with these characters. And then I watched a very good documentary with Matt Damon doing the voiceover. And I suddenly realized that when you look into it a bit more, all these people are total gits. So to then go back and read the book, it was all I could do to finish it, really, because I was thinking, oh, you're awful people, all of you. So to try and get sympathy for people in the financial crisis and, like Nick says, brought down our economy and left us paying for it for years for their own ends is quite a task. But overall, I did enjoy this an awful lot. I enjoyed the sort of ups and downs and pitfalls. And yeah, you can say it follows quite a rise and fall formula, if you like. But I did enjoy the journey very much. And I would certainly recommend anyone who's into new writing does get down to the Southwark Playhouse for the next week or so before this finishes.
We're now going to talk about The River at the Royal Court Upstairs. This is a new play by Jez Butterworth and has caused a lot of controversy because they're only selling tickets on the day, which means that you have to queue or get your mouse button clicked to fill one of the... I thought it was 60 seats, but I've seen somewhere that it's 85. I don't know exactly what number it is. Now, I haven't seen this, but Nick, I believe you have. Could you tell me something about it?
I can tell you something about it, but I can tell you very little about it, because not because of kind of wanting to add to any mystique, because God knows the Royal Court have done quite enough of that themselves. But it's one of those plays where if I even kind of tell you what it's ultimately about, that's a spoiler. You know, it's one of those plays where finding out quite what's going on, quite what the point is, quite how literally and naturalistically we're meant to be taking what's going on is actually part of the experience of watching it. So I can't really, you know, it's not one of those where you can say, well, you know, there's two, these people go and they do this and then this happens. So it's a tricky one in that respect. What I can say obviously is that it's set in a log cabin. It's a man and his new girlfriend who he's taken there for fishing, and that's Dominic West playing. All the characters are nameless. Dominic West is playing the man in it. Miranda Raisin is playing the new girlfriend, and Laura Donnelly appears later in the play in another role. That's pretty much as I can say about the specifics of it. It is a very good play. It's very, very different from Jerusalem. It's still got the very lyrical language in a very different way, and it's an excellent play. It kind of makes you think about certain things and to do with kind of reality and the important and the things you might have thought were important in your life and kind of putting a spin on the things that have happened to you that have kind of become memorable. Like I said, it's a really difficult one to say anything about without spoiling the whole thing. It's certainly not one that for a minute I buy any of the justifications for putting it in that tiny space, let alone for making it so hard to buy tickets. I mean, the latest excuse at time of recording, and by the time this actually goes out, that there may be another new one, is that it was Jez Butterworth who had writer's block and could only continue writing if he knew for a fact that it was that the play was going on in the upstairs theatre initially. Like I say, this is the most recent of many justifications we've been given for the location and the way that the tickets have been put on sale. So I think the Royal Court's kind of claim to the moral high ground on this is a bit slippery. And I mean, I think they're already kind of making kind of little admissions that it will. That they are expecting it to have a life beyond this, which I think we all. I mean, this is unusual because this is a play we've actually discussed on the podcast in some length months before we knew anything about it because of the whole controversy about the ticketing, and you know I would love to be able to just go in there and see the play and decide what I think about it entirely on the basis of itself. And I think if it was absolutely the greatest thing you've ever seen in your life, you could forget all about everything, about how you got in. And I mean, as it happens, I was lucky in that although it kind of does show up another problem with the booking, is that I didn't go on the night that I was expecting to because somebody I know ended up with too many tickets because a couple of people were trying at the same time to get two tickets between them and ended up with two each, which is kind of, it's all a bit reminiscent of the Olympics tickets all over again. So it shows another kind of issue with this kind of arranged panic behind buying the tickets, is that things like this will happen. You'll end up with less than you want or more than you want. Nobody will quite end up with exactly what they want. But, you know, with that, it's because of the way they've done it, they've kind of brought it on themselves to have you judge everything about it up against the excuses they gave for making, you know, making it such a hard time to get to see the thing. So it's probably not any of the creative's fault, but it's certainly one where you don't, it's not quite to the point where you think, I don't care, you know, it's justifies everything that they've done for it. I can't really say that it does. I think, you know, it's a very, very good play. Is it something that deserves to kind of stop everything and rearrange your life around for a month in the hope of getting a ticket for? I'm not sure anything is as good as that. I don't think this is.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure how whether or not I'm even going to try to see it. I think I might just wait until it goes wherever it's going to go. But certainly, I mean, think about Jess Butterworth is before Jerusalem. He would have, you know, a new play on the Royal Court wouldn't have got anyone's interest up anyway, because although he was rated as a good writer, I don't think his plays were really, you know, really sought after.
Well, I mean, I think we talked about this at the time that they announced this as well, and, you know, all the upstairs shows this season are by writers who have written for the Royal Court before, but it just so happens that it's the one who had the massive transatlantic hit who has this whole issue around the booking. You know, and it's just I don't know anybody who doesn't think it's a publicity scam to get, you know, crowds outside the Royal Court queuing so they can say in 6 months' time, hey, remember that show that you couldn't get into for love nor money? It's in the West End now. I don't know anybody who doesn't think that's the reason behind it. And how, you know, I think we might slightly have respected the Royal Court more if they just said that from the start, but. You know, obviously that was never going to happen, but but Paul's seen it as well, so I'll let him say what he thought about it as well.
Yeah, Paul, what did you think?
Well, I had a kind of it was a wonderful experience actually, an incredibly kind soul day seated for me. So all I had to do was just show up at the Royal Court at the appropriate time, and we sat in the front row. And there's no, you know, height or anything on the stage. So the three of them were directly there in front of me. And I was spellbound pretty much for the entire 75 minutes. And Nick's right. Unfortunately, we can't say too much about it. I think we can say that you'll know an awful lot more about fly fishing by the time the play ends than you do at the start. But yeah, the performances I thought were uniformly wonderful. I don't remember watching Philadelphia Here I Come and thinking, oh, you know, Laura Donnelly was excellent. And I know she didn't have much of a part in that, but I thought in this she just blew me away entirely, really. I don't know about you two, but I would actually put an age limit on this as well. I wouldn't let anyone under the age of about 25, 27 see this. I think, or maybe you need to have your heart broken at least once, I would say. Maybe if you were 24 years old and you could produce some sort of letters or evidence of having your heart broken, then you could get a ticket for it. You know, that doesn't seem too much of extra effort for the Royal Court to go to compared to what they're doing. Interestingly, though, pretty much everyone I know of who's tried to get a ticket online has got one. I don't know if this is some kind of pre-reviews event or benefit, but it doesn't seem to be that hard to actually get a ticket. I mean, I would give it a go on a free night if you've got one, Tim, to be honest. But I think you're being a bit harsh, Nick, on the... I did enjoy the intimacy of seeing it in that little space with 80-odd people, but on the other hand, obviously the staging is perfectly set up for it to go straight to the Royal Court downstairs, for instance, or more likely, I suppose, into the West End. But I would go the full five stars, I think. You know, Dominic West's performance is wonderful. Big fan of The Wire, so great to see him so close on stage. If you can get a ticket and you do live in London, obviously if you're outside of London, then forget it. But if you do live in London, then I do recommend going along.
I agree. I probably come across a lot harsher on it than I actually am. And like I say, I think if you didn't have this always in the back of your head, I think this would be a solid. It probably is. I mean, I probably would call it a solid five stars as
it's
well.
It's brouhaha, isn't it?
It's the brouhaha and the faff. It's, you know, it's the fact that you know, I just don't think it's in anyone's it's to anyone's benefit to have the theatre essentially kind of alienate quite so much of its audience before it's even walked into the theatre, you know. And I think what you're doing there is kind of entirely at no fault of the creatives who are on stage or kind of writing or directing. You're kind of giving them that extra mile to go. But yes, it's certainly, I mean, it's kind of, yes, it's easy for me to say that, yes, it would work perfectly well in a bigger theatre because I was also, you know, sitting right there in the front row. But yes, certainly as soon as you see the staging, you have no question that this would just literally kind of, well, it could be taken apart and, you know, rebuilt on a West End stage in, you know, in overnight. So it's kind of pretty hard to, and I think, you know, it's also what makes it tricky is that very shortly Constellations is going to the West End, and I mean, I think you know, most of us, I think, who were there on Saturday had also seen Constellations, and I think it's quite ludicrous to say that somebody sat down and thought, you know what, Constellations will quite easily go into a West End theatre, but The River won't. You know, I think the fact that we were fed that line is quite a ridiculous thing to try and to try and believe. But yes, I wonder whether, I mean, the thing with the availability of tickets, I think, yes, absolutely. I know of like one person who didn't manage to get tickets online, and I think they sold out within 30 seconds, but on that particular day. But I wonder, yes, whether it might be easier than people think, simply because the Royal Court annoyed so many people that a lot of people have just gone, well, I won't bother then. You know, whether people have just gone, okay, that's just not in my, you know, if you want to make it really difficult to see your show, then I won't see your show.
I tell you, though, one argument they did make back when this first happened was suggesting that if they had put all the tickets on sale to members, there would have been members that wouldn't have been able to get a ticket. So that was something they said to Revstan, actually, when she wrote to complain. I mean, so for me as a non-member, it actually gave me a chance to see this show. I don't know how many members they've got, you know, but there is a very limited number of tickets for an entire upstairs run. I mean, is it VB Crow or I can't remember what the guy's...
Evie Crow,
and I think she's a woman, isn't she?
Yes, it's a she, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Evie Crow, who's kin, which I didn't think too much of. I mean, her next play is upstairs next after this, and that's totally sold out already anyway. It's interesting. It's interesting.
I think that's the other thing that's interesting about it is that when you kind of make these claims about why you've got to sell this one in this way, it kind of it kind of implies certain things about everything else that you sell the normal way. You know, it's kind of well from so the next one's the one that you didn't think was good enough to make the fuss about. You know, it's essentially what it, obviously not the intention, but that's kind of, you know, the implication is, you know, well, oh, so this is the one that you know, people can just buy in advance if they feel like it, because you're not as keen on that one.
We're now going to talk about 55 Days by Howard Brenton. This is on at the Hampstead Theatre, and as I've just been informed, is the first play that Edward Hall commissioned when he became artistic director. Howard Brenton's got quite a history of, quite a good history of writing these sort of historical plays, as it were. His Anne Boleyn of Shakespeare's Globe has done lots of touring and was a, you know, very, very well regarded piece. And I think this one probably comes up close. It has a very good performance by Mark Gatiss as Charles I. The only thing wrong with his performance, I think, was that he's about at least a head too high to be Charles I. Charles I was very short. And also you have Douglas Henshall. You don't often see Douglas Henshall, and I most often see him in rather bad romantic comedies, the British romantic comedies. He seems to turn up in those a lot. But he's a good actor, and this is really rather good performance as Oliver Cromwell. It's interesting that they have an Englishman playing a king who was a Scot, essentially, and we have a Scotsman who's playing an Englishman, which is I don't know if that was deliberate, but it's rather it does work. Essentially, 55 Days is about the trial and execution of Charles I, and this sort of from the point where they decide to put him where they decide to put him on trial to the point where they actually kill him, and we get a depiction of his trial, and we get a depiction of this unfairness, I suppose you'd call it, the rather it does. I'm not sure whose side Howard Brenton is on. I think he's trying to be even-handed, but you do feel that they've really decided just to kill the man, and they're looking for a reason, you know, a legal way of doing it. And it's really quite a fascinating piece on the power. And you see that you know, Charles I makes various big mistakes because he simply won't recognise people that people would ever want to kill the king, and he just doesn't believe it throughout until really up until the point where they, you know, he knows that they're going to do it. It's a really, I mean, you kind of know the ending of this play from the start, because if you know any history, but I don't suppose you know, everybody's going to know the exact history of it. But it's I thought it was really well done. It's done largely in modern dress, although Charles I is in period dress. I didn't have any problem with that. Paul, what did you think about this?
No, I mean, I saw the second preview, but you couldn't have told, really. It was absolutely on point already. And, you know, I thoroughly enjoyed Anne Boleyn, thoroughly enjoyed this gripping script. I think I counted 29 in the cast. I mean, not all of those are speaking roles, but, yeah, large cast with... The reason I booked in part, I suppose, was for Mark Gatiss, and I'll always go and see him on stage. I think he's a thoroughly enjoyable presence, but he doesn't stand out in this particularly, because the acting across the board is so good. I got it into my head that Douglas Henschel was George Galloway. He looks a little bit like George Galloway, speaks in the play a little bit like George Galloway, so that was hard to shake out of my head. And then at the interval, my dad said, they've got Kenneth Branagh playing Oliver Cromwell, so that didn't help either. But no, Henschel's great, Gatiss is great. One thing I would say is don't sit in the first two rows, because there's no rake, and also some of the staging is done to sort of obstruct the view of the first two rows as well. So third row and back is good for this one, I would say. But no, I mean, I thoroughly recommend getting down to Hampstead. I don't know if it will have any life beyond Hampstead, but it probably deserves to be honest. It's a good time for new writing just at the moment.
Yeah, Nick, what did you think about this?
Yeah, I pretty much agree with Paul, right down to the stay out of the front two rows thing. On both sides, I would add, because it is in traverse, which is quite nicely done in there. They've not done a lot of traverse in Hampshire. They did a very, very wide traverse for Tiger Country, was it, I think? It was, yeah, the medical one. Yeah. But it's another setup that works really well in there. And that's I'm a bit of a kind of a set design geek, so I get quite I like the fact that in the last couple of years I've actually remembered that it's a studio theatre, and they've been kind of playing around with it. But yes, I thought that I like the idea of Charles I being in period costume while everybody else isn't. Although what kind of period everybody else was in was a bit vague to me. It kind of seemed to be largely Second World War, and then sometimes right up to modern dress. There was certainly some very old-fashioned typewriters being used that I wouldn't have called part of a modern dress production. The person I was with actually said that he thought the set reminded him of Churchill's war rooms, which is possibly what they were trying to go to with the design theme. No, I thought it was very interesting, because the history I studied at school wasn't English history, so although I have read much about it, you'll probably not be too surprised to know that most of my history comes from theatre, and this... Funnily enough, really, you'd think this would be something that did get covered a lot, but funnily enough, it's not a period that seems to get covered in theatre a lot. So it's an interesting subject, and it's an interesting couple of people to centre it on. I mean, yes, the performances all round are very good, so it doesn't feel like a starring, you know, it's not kind of one that feels like it's based entirely around its two stars, but certainly the story is one that you can't help but see the similarities between them as well as the differences. And it's interesting that these are kind of two people who both of them absolutely believe that they are the person God will talk to, and that they are the chosen vessel of God. And so that's I think quite that certain things aren't just part of history. I think certain things are never change, and that's certainly one of them. And obviously, you're going to get a major clash between them. I think I was interested in the way Cromwell comes across, because I think he's one of those figures who you kind of have a particular image of. And actually, I think that the Cromwell we see is a very slippery character, but he's also quite hard to get an idea of who he really is. He's you kind of hear talk of this General Ironsides who can, you know, walk into the room and everybody quakes, but actually who you're seeing is quite a lot more doubt in him than you might expect from the descriptions. And he seems to be a person who kind of talks like he's very moderate, but actually he's always kind of somewhere in the background whenever all the big stuff happens, and the power always just seems to gravitate towards him somehow.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre podcast page in Facebook. On the web we are ayu-londontheatre.org, and the podcast can also be found on iTunes, where you can leave a review. Thank you, goodbye.